Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, February 5th, 2025, and our friend Tony Norfield is back with us. Welcome back, Tony.
Thank you.
Let's get started with the situation in the Middle East and the way that Donald Trump, in his meeting with Netanyahu, was talking about Gaza, taking over Gaza and maybe moving these people to Egypt and Jordan. And the United States would be in charge of rebuilding Gaza for settlers, it seems to me. How did you find it?
Well, something like this has been floated for a while, not in this extreme a manner, of course, on the U.S. side. Like Jared Kushner, you know, Trump's son-in-law, was talking about, you know, having beachfront properties in Gaza. But the issue of taking over Gaza, which is what he said explicitly, that's really kind of torn up all forms of, you know, legality, basically, regarding Palestine. You know, plenty of other things have been torn up regarding Palestine as well on the legal front, but, you know, this is quite an extreme thing. And if you like, it got so bad that even the Europeans had to come out. You know, they're all strongly pro-Israel, but they had to come out and say that they're against the enforced deportation or annexation and, you know, an ethnic cleansing, basically, of Gaza. This has been a long-term plan of the Israeli state, before Netanyahu, under different governments. And they had, when they so-called handed over Gaza and they got rid of a bunch of Israeli settlers in there and moved them out, this was 20 years ago, something like that. They then still put a huge amount of limitations on them, because the whole idea was to slowly make it unlivable. And then they got their excuse to make it unlivable in 2006, I think it was, when Hamas got elected. And since then, it's been an open-air concentration camp, basically. But this kind of long-term plan obviously stepped up in the wake of October the 7th. But it's been part of their overall plan for a long time. And, you know, the greater Israel, everything. The interesting thing, among others, about the Israeli state is that they don't define their borders. Because, you know, they've got the biblical stuff, more or less saying it's everywhere. And they would never properly say, you know, say on the border of Lebanon, here's where the border should be, or the border of Syria, here's where the border should be. They've never really said that. So all of this is part of the Israeli state structure. It's not simply Netanyahu. And he's just, you know, done it in a more aggressive, open fashion. And now with Trump, heavily financed by a lot of Zionist money, he's got a backer for that. But it looks pretty unlikely to happen, actually, because it's true, as Trump pointed out, that Gaza's been destroyed, but, you know, who did the destruction? You know, and everybody knows who did the destruction: American weapons, Israeli murders. So, you know, this is going to be a big political problem. And it's something which I think will kind of highlight the illegitimacy of the Israeli state. You know, this has happened a little bit here and there with the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, doing various measures against Israeli murderers. But this, I think, is so over the top. And then when you had Trump coming out and saying that, you know, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, they'll all go along with this, no problem. Well, they've all denied that they would. And it's not as if they're greatly sympathetic with the Palestinians. They've done nothing, basically, in the past 15, 16 months about the Gaza genocide. But Egypt and Jordan are very worried about an influx of refugees that would destabilize their own countries. Jordan already has had a, you know, a couple of hundred thousand or more Palestinian refugees who've escaped or been kicked out, basically. And, you know, they've adopted a pro-Israeli line, basically, and they've done nothing about all the incursions of Israel. When the Iranians did some attacks on them, on Israel, the weapon systems in Jordan, not necessarily Jordanian soldiers doing it, but they were trying to do some air defense missiles and things to stop some of the flow of weapons going across. So, you know, again, they've got no sympathy really with the Palestinians, the leaders of those countries, but they have a problem if they get a load of refugees, that's for sure. And in particular, there's a sizable part of their populations who are not necessarily Palestinian, but are very sympathetic to the Palestinians. So if they went ahead with anything like this in this such an overt manner, that would cause a lot of potential disruption politically for them. And, you know, even if you're apparently an unassailable kind of tyrant like the King of Jordan, you know, you're going to be a bit worried about that. So I think this is a non-starter. Also because, you know, where is the US going to come up with the money for the billions and billions to reconstruct these Riviera hotels on the coast of Gaza? And the Palestinians themselves, they're not moving. And, you know, in a way, that's almost the biggest surprise, that have had the most dreadful oppression and they've managed to, you know, keep a real resilience and not to move out of the territory. You know, there have been some people who left to get medical treatment, things like this, but, you know, there's no great outflow of people as Israelis really wanted to happen. So it's a Zionist pipe dream, one that looks not more realistic, but it looks a bit more solid with someone like Trump coming out of it. But it doesn't really change the underlying situation of the, you know, the complete sadistic murders and, you know, Holocaust that the Israelis have done. And I think this will probably add another aspect to the, you know, questioning the nature of the Israeli state, basically. Unfortunately, you know, the way the war went and with the attacks on Syria and Lebanon, you know, it doesn't look like anything particularly in a big way is going to happen soon. But I think all the pressures for Palestinian liberation are still there because they won't give up. You know, they never have given up. And the issue, I think, that comes to the fore now regarding Palestinian leadership, you know, it's for them to decide, not for me to babble on about it. But I think just the disgraceful role of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, even that's now being undermined because the Israelis want to take over the West Bank. you know, they've destroyed all kinds of areas, you know, refugee camp in Jenin and things like this. But that will completely undermine the fragile hold that the Palestinian Authority has got. And I think it just opens up maybe a, you know, whole bunch of other possibilities. Not in the near term, and I think, because, you know, there's been a lot of destruction, and it's going to be difficult for them to reestablish some ability to fight back. But, you know, the momentum is not going to go away.
The policy of removing Gazans from their land and sending them to Egypt and Jordan, it's not new. We know that the Biden administration tried to do everything in order to facilitate that, which were not successful in achieving that before leaving Washington. And what's the difference right now, and how Donald Trump is feeling that he's going to be different than Joe Biden and his administration? We know that right after this sort of rhetoric on the part of Donald Trump that he wants to just remove these Gazans from their land, we have Saudi Arabia saying that they're not going to go along with that. There has to be a two-state solution. Turkey is talking about the same way. And we don't see that Yemenis and Saudi would back down on what they have planned to, the way that they have confronted Israel so far. We have Hezbollah, we have Hamas, not weaker than before October 7th. And here comes the question, what has changed since then that Donald Trump feels so confident that he's going to change the policy, he's going to remove these people?
I see no basis for that whatsoever. You know, the, say, the Jordanian king's regime would be under great threat if they had, you know, 100,000 Palestinians came in, or, you know, more probably. Same for Egypt. And Egypt rejected it last time, partly for honorable reasons, you might say. They didn't want to take part in the depopulation of Gaza. But they too see a big problem of political instability if, you know, several hundred thousand people from Gaza came into Egypt. But from Trump, I think it shouldn't be underestimated how stupid Trump is. He probably sees Egypt on a map. Oh, that's a big place. Surely you've got some room. You know, something like that. You know, forget about the, you know, the immediate area on the west of the Gaza border is desert, essentially. And, you know, an amount of Egypt is desert anyway. You know, it just completely disrupt the whole country. I'd say, quite apart from any moral or political assessment, it would be a big mess. But the US has been so confident about being able to dominate everybody. You know, it's managed to keep Egypt under wraps for quite a long time now. And, you know, the Jordanians were never a problem for them anyway. You know, it's a big military base for the British and the Americans. But I really see no basis for that. As you mentioned, the Saudis, even the Saudis, you know, it's a bit too embarrassing. If you call yourself the, you know, the home of Mecca and Medina, and, you know, you go and do this kind of thing, you know, that would really start to cause some problems even within Saudi Arabia, I think. Didn't stop the Saudis, you know, basically providing implicit support for Israel before. I think, as we might have mentioned in a previous discussion, you know, that they've helped, while the Yemenis closed off the Red Sea for the Israelis, There's a land route from the United Arab Emirates and from the Saudi coast, land route over into Jordan, then to go to Israel. So the Saudis and the other Gulf states have been helping that, and they haven't stopped. I meant to look at what the Yemenis have been up to recently. You know, I normally keep an eye on the port information for inflows and exports on Israeli ports. But it's probably the case that Eilat port is still closed down. Maybe things open up a little bit, but the Yemenis made it clear that they would only stop the blockade if they saw that a ceasefire was being properly implemented. And what we're seeing instead is any excuse that Israel has to continue the murders, basically. And, you know, they've let a few aid trucks in into different parts of Gaza, but, you know, the bombings and the killings and the drone attacks are still going on.
The other issue that Donald Trump was talking about was the nuclear program of Iran, that he wants to negotiate with Iranians, not to attack. Because before that, we were talking about Netanyahu is pushing for a war, a direct war with Iran. But Donald Trump said that that's not possible. I'm not gonna go to war with Iran. I'm gonna negotiate with them. And he tried to do his way of talking about the negotiation and the deal.
Yeah, that I think does show the limits of Netanyahu's power, even, you know, given all the bribes and everything else. Because the what the US military, and they've probably told Trump this, what the US military realize is that Iran has now got, you know, a pretty good array of weapons, and it wouldn't be a walkover like they thought it would have been in earlier times. So the reluctance to do much against Iran and instead, you know, talking about doing some kind of nuclear deal, that's an interesting move. And that will kind of contradict the Netanyahu approach, who always wanted the Americans to attack Iran. So that's a welcome change anyway. It wasn't entirely clear, you know, whether a Biden administration would have gone ahead with that kind of thing. But the problem that they face, and they've been warned about it actually by Iran, is that all the American bases in the Middle East will get smacked basically by Iran. You know, they don't need to send missiles over to New York or something, but there are plenty of American bases all around the region, and they could hit them, and they couldn't do anything about it, really, given the kinds of missiles that they've got. And if they tried to put a naval force into the Persian Gulf, then that would risk bigger losses than they were facing with Yemen. You know, because the US Navy couldn't even handle Yemen, basically. So when it comes to, you know, handling anti-ship missiles and various things from the Iranians, they'd really be in a bad way. And I think some years ago there was this was even before the latest Iranian missile developments, there was a scenario set out by American military planners, and they tried different options, on every one the US forces got defeated. You know, it's kind of like a war game type setup that they had. And yeah, so they'd be in a pretty vulnerable position, actually. You know, they could do a lot of damage to Iran, that's for sure. But it would be not an easy thing to do. So it's not the kind of thing that you could sort out with a one-off Trump missile, you know, which supposedly sorts out a problem that he faces. So it's a much bigger deal.
Here comes the policy of Donald Trump in Europe. How do you find it right now? He started with Canada, Mexico, and China.
Yeah. I think it's worth stepping back a little bit. And, you know, the initial things were more Mexico, Canada, and Panama. And that's, you know, with Rubio has gone off to Panama and things like this. And it's a sign in the way that it's, well, sorry, Greenland as well. You should obviously need to own in Greenland. But it's a sign in the way that there's a bit more of, you can't call it isolationist, but this kind of retrenchment of US forces and the and US military kind of, you know, homeland security type thing, as he would put it. There's more of a focus on sorting out North America, you know, including Panama, I guess, in that respect. On Panama, he just exaggerates, you know, what he's calling Chinese control, when the Panamanians have said there isn't any Chinese control. What are you talking about? And on Greenland, they've already got a big military base in Greenland anyway, but no doubt a lot of the military hawks in the US would like an even bigger base, and taking it over, you know, there's this kind of nonsense which has been repeated with Ukraine, that you look at a place, you see it's got lots of resources, you think, oh wow, you know, there's trillions of dollars of, you know, gold, raw materials, rare earths, and all this kind of stuff. And you ignore how much money it costs to get the stuff out of the ground and process it. And this is actually on a separate topic. This is the big problem with his rare earth stuff. You know, the only people who are any good at transforming the rare earth raw material into usable, you know, raw materials are the Chinese, basically. And most other countries are not very good at doing it at all. But and essentially, I think that the main Trump focus is kind of greater America, you know, so Canada, 51st state, this kind of stuff, and pressure on Mexico. But he is doing it in a way to completely piss them off. And it's just his negotiating tactics, I think, on the tariffs. It's just like make a big noise about it and hopefully frighten them into making concessions. So they got the Canadians and the Mexicans to move troops to their respective borders to stop the, you know, inflow of drugs and migrants and whatever. So it's, I think we're going to see a lot more of this. There'll be, you know, many more what look like crazy policies. Then you're never quite sure, and this is part of the strategy, you're never quite sure which ones he actually means and which ones might get heavily amended or changed completely in a few days' time.
I think to understand Donald Trump, you have to look at his first term, in which he was trying to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. He said, Mexico going to pay for it.
Yeah.
I couldn't finish it before leaving Washington. Here comes a big, he comes with big ideas and nobody knows how is he going to achieve those ideas. Yeah. And here comes to, how do you find his policy in Europe, the way that he's talking about putting tariffs on Europe and forcing Europeans in order to increase their defense budget from 2% to 5%, which would be devastating for many European countries?
Yeah. Well, the rhetoric has had an effect already, actually. So the French or Macron anyway, I mean, he's got to get it through some budget process, but he's promised to double defense spending. I can't remember what that would be. Probably it's about 2% now, so maybe it's 4%. And the UK is also, they weren't mentioned, you know, under this Europe thing. Normally Trump is bothered about the EU because he's got the trade deficit issue in his head all the time. So look at, you know, the European Union, you know, they're doing unfair things to us in trade, et cetera, et cetera. But the UK also quickly buckled down and said, you know, promising to buy more weapons from the US and buy more oil and gas, that kind of stuff, you know. The Europeans themselves are freaking out about it, or the EU, I should say, are freaking out about it. And it's not entirely clear what they're going to do. I think von der Leyen unexpectedly said, well, we'll do tariffs back or something. But, you know, there is a lot of trade between EU countries and the US. And I think that they would find it difficult to do much. They didn't really do much when they were faced with tariffs on steel imports. You know, and there's been a whole bunch of cases in the past where they've done a bit in retaliation, but hardly anything. And of course, it just gives the US more leeway to do some more next time. But the tariff thing in general, I haven't seen it today, but, you know, recently it had a bit of a hit on equity prices, because clearly extremely disruptive for the supply chains and the multiple border crossings of goods and material. So, you know, that's bad for business, basically. But, you know, he'd come out with this crap and then have to change it. So for Canada and Mexico, things are put off for a month until he maybe gets what he wants. For Europe, he hasn't given any numbers, I don't think. I haven't seen anything yet anyway. So the Europeans haven't done anything yet because they want to see what's going on. The Chinese, though, did do something. So they've come up with a bunch of tariff increases and export controls. Plus, they've decided to do cases against Google, and I think Apple as well, on market manipulation. So, you know, there's going to be retaliation, even if, you know, the US vassals are more in a state of shock and despair. They think, oh, God, we've got another 4 years of this to put up with, you know. But when it comes to, say, Russia and China, Trump's outbursts will have no impact whatsoever.
Do you think that he wants to put an end to the war in Ukraine, or he's just trying to drag it on?
He probably does want to put an end to it because it costs a lot of money. So, you know, part of his gambit was to say, okay, we'll, he stopped the kind of social welfare type aid. But the military aid, at least the weapons in transit, were still going. But the thing he came up with, of course, was to say, well, okay, Ukraine's got a lot of raw materials. You know, they should give us the raw materials. we give you the Abrams tanks and the Patriot missile systems, and you give us a load of raw materials.
All of them, most of them are located in the eastern part of Ukraine under the control.
Yeah, well, the Americans in general, and Trump in particular, is not very good with maps. There's 60-70% are in Russian controlled areas. So and again you'd have to build the stuff from scratch. Quite a lot, whereas, you know, Russia can do, say, rare earth processing. China is very good at it, and they can do a whole lot of other stuff. Whereas in Ukraine, for the last like 30 odd years, they've done next to no investment and things are falling apart. You know, they're just the most corrupt, money grabbing kind of sinkhole of a country when it comes to investment. You know, so you know, you had Zelensky the other day, you know, saying he doesn't know where $100 billion has gone, you know, that kind of thing. So so no wonder Trump wants to stop that. You don't have to be a genius businessman to realize that you're wasting money. But he's in the mode of thinking that, number one, Russia is on its knees, or Russia's losing a million people, that kind of thing. Neither of which is true in the slightest. And he also thinks that, you know, he can offer something to do some deal because he's a great deal maker. But anything that he comes up with, you know, the Russians are not going to believe. You know, they've already had all the Minsk stuff, Minsk 1, Minsk 2, and all the other betrayals. So they're just not going to believe it. And although the Ukraine war is going very slowly in the sense of territory taken over, but it's clearly having an effect of wearing down the Ukrainian military quite drastically and, you know, depleting NATO supplies of weapons. Because Russia has always had in its mind that really it's fighting the US and NATO rather than Ukraine per se. And obviously that's come true with all the supplies that they've been given in the past couple of years. So I think that a Ukraine deal with Trump, no way. What will happen though, because the Russians are, you know, a bit legalistic and don't want to turn off things completely, they'll always talk about, yes, we're open to discussion, constructive discussion, practical, you know, problem-solving discussion, that kind of thing. But they've made it very clear what their problem-solving discussion should include. You know, and in particular what they want. And this is, I think, part of the reason why the war is going on for so long, that they want to sort out so-called European security more broadly, not simply can we smash up Ukraine quickly and then have the war over with, because they know that, you know, it just causes problems further on. So what they want to do is put the Europeans, if not the US, into a situation where they have to accept that there's a revision to all of these kind of international deals that had been in place but have effectively been torn up in recent years.
Tony, when you look at Europe today and the way they're talking about increasing the defense budget from 2% to 5%, what is the main logic behind all of this, these sort of discussions in Europe? They know that Russia would not attack them and China is not in the same position. And they're trying to picture Russia and China as their enemy, at least if not China, Russia obviously is their enemy in the mind of these people who are running Europe. But how are they going to convince Europeans, people in these European countries, that they're going to be under attack, they're going to be attacked by Russia? Because before going to that increase from 2 to 5%, you have to convince the public opinion in Europe. You cannot do it just simply. Mm-hmm. How is there any sort of foundation for this sort of thinking in your opinion?
Well, at the moment, you've got a political elite, a certain generation who are in charge. And, you know, they've been brought up on Russophobia, Russia's a threat and everything else. And for the Europeans in particular, the Ukraine war is a big shock. You know, kind of shouldn't have been given what they were doing beforehand, but it was a big shock. And the, you know, outrageous, you know, brutal invasion, all that kind of stuff. because they've been used to having a pretty free hand of doing all kinds of things, moving into Eastern Europe and expanding the EU, for example. But they're in a really bad way economically. Growth is pretty stagnant, evidently in Germany. France has got a big budget deficit already. Italy's, you know, not in a good situation either. So you've got pretty stagnant growth, and the idea of persuading your populace that you can shift a couple of percent of GDP into defense, I think will be very difficult. But the thing is, though, that it doesn't necessarily change their minds, you know, and partly the impression of what Europeans think is often given by people like von der Leyen and now Kaya Kallas as the vice president of the European Commission. You know, they don't really represent anyone, but they're the big mouths pretending to formulate policy. The policy really is done by the heads of European states and the Council of Ministers. But if you're the head of the European Commission, the civil service, like von der Leyen, then you can kind of pretend that because you can do a lot of PR and you can promote this and you've got a budget, you can kind of pretend that you're the one in charge, and she isn't. That said, as I say, there's a bunch of European politicians who pretty Russophobic and, you know, do see a threat, even if there isn't one. I think most Europeans don't. And, you know, the older ones anyway, know what a war is like. You know, wasn't that long ago, basically. So the idea of having a war is a problem, but that hasn't stopped, say, the Baltic states, Poland, Germany, and the Scandinavians from doing all kinds of exercises around the Baltic Sea and in northern Finland and places like this. So they're doing all these exercises and, stepping up this notion of the big Russian threat. And the joke is that, you know, the biggest loudmouth ones, usually called the Chihuahuas in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, pretty small populations, you know, tiny militaries, and formerly had very strong trading relationships with Russia, but have now messed all that up. And all they've got to sell now, especially a country like Estonia, is Russophobia. That's all they can sell. But, you know, you can't run an economy on Russophobia. I think then that my conclusion would be that the existing political elites, and they're only here and there being challenged by oppositional forces, the existing political elites still largely in the old mode of being anti-Russia, you know, anti-communist in inverted commas and whatever else. But you are finding, say, in Germany, you've got the right-wing Alliance for Deutschland. In France, they had to do some clever tricks on the parliament to prevent Marine Le Pen's national rally from having a bigger role. Austria, I think there's some moves there also. And in a bunch of other places, you know, in particular, say, Hungary and Slovakia, they don't want this to go on and don't see the logic in it. But it will probably take a number of more of these smaller European countries, because I think it's going to be tougher to get rid of Macron. And the president in France has a great deal of power. More like the king, basically, in terms of power, rather than necessarily finding it a big problem to get something through parliament. Germany, there could well be quite a big change there soon, because Scholz and the existing parties, they've completely discredited themselves. And I think it's only the reluctance on the part of a lot of Germans to vote for a right-wing party that is probably preventing Alliance for Deutschland from doing more, you know, despite Elon Musk's help. But basically, but so I think that things are on the way to show political pressure against this crazy move to build up military and have a war with Russia. But you only had, I think, the Baltic states, Poland, and the British. Actually, maybe France, talking in vague terms about putting some forces into Western Ukraine. It's a complete joke, you know. I mean, the Russians will wipe them out in 5 minutes anyway. But I don't think they'll do it, basically. They've got not much of a military anyway. And this is part of the reason they want to boost their military spending. But it's just they're not in a position to do it.
Just before wrapping up, Tony, this session, do you think that the party, the political parties and the changes that are happening in Germany would allow them or would make them capable of reconnecting the pipeline between Germany and Russia?
It's entirely possible. The problem they would face is that they would need to own up who blew up the first one. And, you know, that's more or less a state secret now. You know, I mean, everyone knows who did it, but basically, you know, all kinds of fake stories about, you know, Ukrainians on a yacht or something like that. So I think, though, it's possible, and that's their stated policy. And a lot of German business would be very much in favor of it. But when you see that to fix the pipeline would probably take a few billion dollars worth of money. You know, why would Russia spend a penny on that? So they'd have to fix the pipeline first to show commitment. And then maybe. So all of this is still way down the line. And in the meantime, Russia is selling them oil and gas through other methods, you know, through India, through Turkey, and through LNG deliveries. So Russia's not that bothered about it. You know, they did lose a market, you know, don't underestimate that. They did lose an important market, but they've now developed alternative markets to a reasonable degree, maybe not quite entirely, but to a reasonable degree to get money from China and India and other countries in the East. So I think, yes, in brief then, it's possible to reopen Nord Stream, but they probably have to do the fixing of it first to show a commitment. Otherwise, you know, why would Russia bother to turn the thing on again?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Tony, for being with us today. Great pleasure to have you back.
Thank you.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye now.
Take care.